And Jim Robinson, KZFR, is putting money back into the pockets of our local performing musicians. So that's why we've created the KZFR Cares About Musicians Fund. This fund is intended to put money back into the pockets of those who have contributed to this amazing artistic community. We're looking for local musicians and DJs who, because of the COVID and stay-at-home orders, are currently out of work. If you would like to be a recipient of the KZFR Cares About Musicians Fund, simply go to kzfr.org/kzfrcares and fill out the application. The application is live until July 10th, and all applications must be submitted by July 10th. If you would like to donate to contribute to the KZFR Cares About Musicians Fund, you can go to kzfr.org/donate and simply click the KZFR Cares About Musicians Fund button. If you'd like more information, you can email grant@kzfr.org. Once again, that's kzfr.org/kzfrcares to fill out an application, and all applications are due by July 10th.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we'll discuss American exceptionalism and American innocence, a people's history of fake news from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. We're joined today by co-author Danny Haifong, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence. Stay with us. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we spend the hour with the co-author of a new book out from Skyhorse Publishing, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. That's by Roberto Servant and Danny Haifong. And today we are fortunate to have co-author Danny Haifong on the line. This book also has a stellar foreword by Ajamu Baraka and also an afterword by the great Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. And Danny Haifong also writes with Black Agenda Report. Danny Haifong is an activist and journalist residing in New York City. He's a regular contributor to the Black Agenda Report and the American Herald Tribune. Haifong's work was recently featured in Cynthia McKinney, former congresswoman, her new book on how the U.S. creates blank hole countries. The FCC doesn't allow us to say that. Danny is also co-author here, as I mentioned, with Roberto Servant, this new book titled American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. I also, again, want to remind our listeners that there is a foreword by Ajamu Baraka, and many people will know Baraka from the Green Party, and also an afterword by the great journalist Glenn Ford, also at the Black Agenda Report. Danny Haifong, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
You have really fantastic bookends to this amazing book out on Skyhorse, with Baraka and Ford really setting up and then sewing up the argument that you and Servant put together in a few hundred pages. This is actually a really great book, I think, for U.S. history courses, critical thinking courses. I'm hoping that it's going to be getting adoption at colleges around the country. I mentioned to you off air some time ago, I myself am looking to adopt it for next semester. But Danny Haifong, how did this project come about between you and Roberto Servant?
It was not too long after the 2016 elections, I think this was the summer afterward, where Roberto reached out to me by email and asked if I was interested in writing a book of short chapters about American exceptionalism. And at the time, I was a little skeptical. I didn't know if a book was something I really wanted to do. But I was willing to engage with him about what his process was, what ideas he had about it. And we found a lot of commonality in our thinking about the idea of American exceptionalism, how it functions as an ideology, its role in the reproduction of the current system of exploitation that dominates in the United States and its global influence. So we began to just talk about different topics. He was an avid reader of Black Agenda Report, and he felt like Black Agenda Report's voice needed to be a big part of the project. So we began just by talking about various issues. A lot of the chapters actually were from the conversations we would have over the phone. We live on opposite ends of the coast, so a lot of it was over Skype, over the phone. And we talked about World War II, for example. Why is the left in the United States so scared almost, or just they have a lot of difficulty in questioning the reality of the U.S.'s role in World War II? We would talk about Colin Kaepernick a lot and his role in bringing about a real necessary conversation about white supremacy and the role of sports in reproducing this myth of American exceptionalism. And we talked a lot about war, especially because in this current period, the U.S. is the warfare state that leads all warfare states in the world in projects of mass destruction. Yet there's very little conversation about that in the United States, and we felt that American exceptionalism is a big reason why, that the normalization of the idea that the U.S. is superior and that superiority is ultimately a white superiority, which gives people, especially in the United States, a lot of leeway to ignore or to just be assaulted ideologically with lies about how other people around the world live, and to dehumanize other people around the world in order to meet the objectives of the warfare state and the ruling class that needs these wars to collect its massive profits.
So, Danny, you mentioned World War II and the American exceptionalism narrative that we tend to have about our role in what you might consider defeating the world's worst empire. What is the role that we see when we look back on that, and how is that flawed?
Ajay Varaka does a really good job in the foreword of the book, bringing in Paul Krugman, who wrote in an op-ed piece that the United States has, he argues, done a lot of wrong around the world, that critics of Iraq, in fact, of the Iraq war, the invasion of Iraq, are right. But when it comes to the United States' overall record, we can look to World War II. The United States has operated as a democratic force in the ongoing struggle against authoritarianism and fascism. That was ultimately the narrative that was born from the U.S.'s new found supremacy coming out of World War II as the number one empire, as the superpower in the world, is that it was able to control the narrative, and Washington was able to promote itself as the force for good that, in fact, defeated fascism. But there are many problems with this argument, not least because the Soviet Union was actually the one that lost the most lives during the war, 27 million, but also was the principal force that actually defeated fascism and was the principal target of fascism throughout the war. But we never hear that, and we also don't hear about the myriad of events that occurred during the U.S.'s participation in World War II, which point to just egregious atrocities, which are out-and-out war crimes. The firebombing of Dresden in 1945, the two nuclear bombs that were dropped on Japan that same year, we can point to a different role that the United States played in World War II, and that was of opportunism and of the need to funnel massive amounts of weapons in order to rebuild its own economy from the Great Depression. So the U.S. used World War II as a grounds for building the military-industrial complex, funneled weapons and money into, first, the Nazi regime. The United States' industrial class, ruling class, was supporting Hitler all the way up until it declared war in 1941, and then it began to support the United Kingdom, Great Britain, in the Lend-Lease policy, while participating in some of the most egregious human rights atrocities that aren't talked about anymore. In the firebombing of Japan, and Dresden, and we can look at all of the acts of intimidation toward the Soviet Union, which the nuclear bombs as well as the firebombing of Dresden represent. We can look at those events as the real manifestations of what the United States was trying to do in World War II. And so it wasn't a good war. Many people died, and the United States ultimately piggybacked off the graves, the mass graves that it produced, as well as just the overall imperialist conflict produced in order to become the number one superpower, which it has used to produce even more egregious atrocities around the world, to the point of 20 to 30 million people have died because of U.S. wars alone.
Danny Haifong, you riffed on so many different themes, threading them together. Coming to mind, of course, Studs Terkel, The Good War, right, riffing on that theme. Jacques Pauwels, the European historian, on the myth of the good war, right, saying that that's part of the propaganda of the ending of World War II and that there was actually not much great to be celebrated in the bigger picture. Of course, in the United States, Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone long talked about this story of World War II and the Soviets and the Soviet role in provoking the United States to drop atomic bombs on Japan because the Soviets were poised to invade and occupy, and the United States didn't want that. They wanted control of Reconstruction. You know, Baraka has a really important foreword to the book that sets all that up that you were just talking about. And in fact, the title is Countering the Violence of Imposed Forgetting. That also reminds me of the great Henry Giroux, who talks about this and the problems of the things that we remember and don't remember, and how there's a violence involved in trying to cover up all of these kinds of atrocities. So it's very important to me as an historian that you start out this way and that you look at some of these very significant challenges that we face. You go through, and again, just to give listeners some idea, again, you can pick up the book. It's American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror by Roberto Servant and Danny Haifong. Danny Haifong, you are with us right now. So you actually do go through United States history, and you start pretty early. You start with an interesting question, of course. Why do they hate us? American Innocence and Historical Memory. Can you riff on that a little bit and then segue into the conquest, genocide, and formation of America?
So we decided to begin the book with an analysis of the War on Terror because we felt that American exceptionalism as an ideology has really been placed on steroids within this broader strategic policy of the United States, the War on Terror, which continues to this day. And in this chapter, we talk about how this narrative, this othering of people around the world especially, which was really put into overdrive during the War on Terror, has ensured that even when there are questions about U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy, that as long as that there's an enemy involved, as long as that there's an enemy that can be pointed to, the United States can always come out looking innocent. And that is what the last almost two decades of the War on Terror have been all about, that the United States has been able to forward this narrative that is under attack and that our freedoms and our democracy and our liberties are under attack, that really allows the U.S. ruling class to justify its endless war in Afghanistan, to its endless involvement in Iraq and its destruction of that society for almost a decade and into today. We have the massive surveillance state that has been erected since the call to wage war on terror in 2001, which now is so big that the NSA and various intelligence agencies are collecting data from every single electronic communication that we are participating in. And so we have these conditions that come out of a real insecurity of the ruling class, the fear that without an enemy, there is no way to justify not only the massive surveillance and endless war, but also economic depravity and the continued decline of the conditions of working people in this country. So racism is the order of the day. That's what we've been dealing with in the War on Terror, this otherization of Arab people, of people who ascribe to the Muslim faith. They have been the scapegoats in all of this. And this has a real root in what we talk about in the next few chapters. After that, we talk about both the original sins of the United States, as sometimes they're referred to, the enslavement of African people and the genocide of indigenous people. These are the founding principles of the economic and social order of the United States. And we can't look at American exceptionalism without understanding how the very idea of the United States being a democracy and being founded upon liberty and the journey to a more perfect union and all of these cliches of the exceptionalist ideology are ultimately byproducts of the fruits of slavery and indigenous genocide. And so we look at works from prominent scholars and activists like Roxane Dunbar-Ortiz, Gerald Horn, who have done so much great work on the real history behind the conquest of the United States and the enslavement of Africans. They argue quite convincingly that not only is the U.S. military state founded upon the forced near extinction of Native people in the United States, but also that the very founding of this country is based upon the desire of the oligarchs here to preserve the system of slavery, and that these two realities alone burst asunder any myth that the United States is somehow exceptional and democratic. But yet, still to this day, we have a situation where very few people are willing to question that on the face. Not even the most radical of leftists sometimes will question the notion that America is great or can be great. Yet we know that bloodshed and massive extermination campaigns on the agenda of the settler colonialists of this country really never had liberty at heart. The liberty for them was always about the liberty to get rich off of the massive deaths of African people and the massive exploitation of their labor and the massive stripping of the land of indigenous people. So until we are able to reckon with those questions, and I think everything really goes back to that, all the questions that we're wrestling with as a progressive and radical movement, until we're able to look at those with clear eyes, those questions, we can't get to debunking American exceptionalism.
We're speaking with Danny Haifong. He is co-author with Roberto Servant of a new book called American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. It's out now from Sky Horse Publishing with a foreword from Ajamu Baraka and an afterword by Glenn Ford. Danny Haifong also writes for Black Agenda Report. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. After this musical break, we'll continue our conversation with author and journalist Danny Haifong. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's show, we are welcoming Danny Haifong. He is co-author with Roberto Servant of a book, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. There's a foreword by Ajamu Baraka, whom many listeners may remember from the Green Party. Also, an afterword by Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. Danny Haifong is an activist and journalist residing in New York City, also a social worker. He is a regular contributor to Black Agenda Report and the American Herald Tribune. Danny Haifong, before the break, you were giving us some background information about exceptionalism, American exceptionalism as a concept, as an ideology, and how many, even some on the left, have a hard time really wrapping their head around how pervasive that myth is in American history. And in fact, it's very closely related to Manifest Destiny around the same period. Alexis de Tocqueville, I believe, was among the first to use the idea or the concept of exceptionalism in describing the United States, the development of the United States, and then, of course, that gets developed through Manifest Destiny. Again, later we'll see manifestations, modernizations of it through the Frontier Thesis, Frederick Jackson Turner, others. After World War II, Pax Americana, we already mentioned the myth of the good war idea, and then the American century. So this is a thread that goes all the way through, and we're fortunate to have you for the hour today because there's so much more to get into. But I wanted to start back, not getting into de Tocqueville, but actually getting into the idea of Manifest Destiny, this self-justifying, purportedly tautological belief system. And John O'Sullivan, a journalist, was one that was originally credited with coining the term. There's some debate about that. In fact, it may have been written. It's likely, in fact, to be written by a journalist and annexation advocate, Jane Pansnew. But regardless, O'Sullivan is somebody that has been credited with this, used it for Texas annexation, used it about border and boundary disputes with Britain and the Oregon country. There's a great quote from O'Sullivan. O'Sullivan, of course, thought the U.S. had some divine mandate, not unlike many of the founders. And he said that that claim, this is a quote, is by the right of our manifest destiny to overspread and possess the whole of the continent, which Providence has given us for the development of the great experiment of liberty and federated self-government entrusted to us. Now, the very phrase manifest destiny means to bring about that which is inevitable. Overspreading, in one sense, means spread over the continent, but perhaps overspread, meaning overreach with federal authority, so it has an ironic meaning there. The whole idea which Providence has given us, Providence in the 19th century with a capital P, was a term that referred to God, right? So we're almost riffing on Charlemagne's divine right of kings here in the proposed or supposed American democracy. So bring us through some of this, because manifest destiny is really what gets us through the Continentalist movement, which was dating back to the 18-teens, 1820s. James K. Polk was also a Continentalist, the supposed dark horse candidate that actually was responsible for starting the Mexican-American War on false pretenses. But America was exceptional, and if we couldn't buy Mexican territory, and if we couldn't cajole Texas away, we could gradually annex it. We could gradually take it. We could fight a war and get it and pay gilt money, pennies on the dollar thereafter. And that's an interesting capitalist model of imperialism, also coupled with racism and white supremacy, as you both argue in your book. Danny Haifong, take it from there, will you?
It's a very important conversation because manifest destiny lies at the heart of the way that the United States has developed its empire and its colonial empire. And one of the real critical aspects of manifest destiny that's so important is that it was an expansionist ideology, and that expansionist ideology was based upon the notion of inherent superiority, and that was justified in terms of being destined by God to take what was already claimed to be the property of the settlers, which was actually the property of indigenous people and of peoples south of the artificial colonial borders of the newly founded United States. So that is really what springboarded the formation of the United States and its colonial empire and its imperialist empire. The Monroe Doctrine would come very closely afterward, where the United States declared under the Monroe administration that Latin America was its backyard and that it had the right, the divine right, to protect the people of Latin America from the so-called imperial boogeyman of Britain and any colonial European power, Spain, whoever it was, which interfered with the United States' divine right to that region. And so this is the story up until the day of the United States. We have a situation where the ruling class of the United States still promotes itself as being ordained to intervene in the affairs of other people based upon its inherent superiority. And it won't say anymore, or at least much of the ruling class, I wouldn't say the whole of the ruling class, but much of it won't say anymore that it's because of God. But they will say it's because of democracy, or it's because of the fact that the United States has the right to intervene based upon human rights atrocities, and the United States has the right to protect, like in Libya. So this narrative of manifest destiny still drives U.S. policy both domestically and abroad. We can look at the way that American exceptionalism and racism are synonymous, but when we look at how the United States justifies its war on drugs policies or its anti-black policies across the board, whether we're talking about the huge mass incarceration regime, which is justified by the fact that there are people, we're told, black people mainly, who are a threat to the safety and security of society. The police every day tell us that they're protecting the safety of communities, they are protecting and serving communities, when in fact the police themselves are rooted in slave patrols, and their history is rooted in the enslavement of African people. That's how the modern police force was formed, and then also their roots in squashing labor unions. There at the struggle for the eight-hour day in the late 1800s when the police were used as breakers of rebellion, of workers who were looking to ensure that their conditions were not so deplorable. So we have a situation where the ruling class is still up to its old game, but it looks different. And the conditions of society have changed, but the roots have not. And American exceptionalism really is an ideology meant to blur those roots. So we can never get to the problem at hand. We're always looking at either certain issues, we'll separate race and class and empire, or we will paint our struggles under the guise of a mission to reform the country and make it what it once was. Even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, in her speeches about climate change, will talk about the romantic days of the World War II period, where the United States was up for the job of addressing the crises at hand, and that's how we got out of the Great Depression, was by saving the world during World War II, right? Stepping up to the plate. When, as we said before, that reality is a lot less clear, the reality is actually that the U.S. was a burgeoning imperialist state, which founded in colonialism, but few, especially in the political establishment, will say that, regardless of how less they are. But even people in the grassroots have a hard time questioning it, because it is embedded in everything we do. And that was part of the book. The book's purpose was to describe how supremacy, American exceptionalism as white supremacy, as the ideology of empire, really has seeped into our political activity and our ability to understand the world as it is, rather than how we've been told it is.
So, Danny Haifong, I think most listeners would agree that there's the attitude of American exceptionalism, but I want to make sure that we really prove home the point that this isn't in itself an ideology. And I think the way that it's been connected to God and religion is really one of the best ways to prove that. And in your book here, you talk about how the United States is serving as God's chosen nation. This, to me, when I read this, reminded me immediately of when we sing or say, "God bless America." You can almost implicitly hear it followed up by, "and no one else." So can you explain a little bit more about how God or religion has been intertwined with American exceptionalism?
I think the biggest part of the God complex of American exceptionalism as an ideology is rooted in white supremacy itself, too. And I think that's the biggest aspect of this notion of God and American exceptionalism, is the fact that who is being defined as God-like, and who and what is being ordained as the arbiters of what it means to carry out God's work. And I think that founding definition of humanity is white humanity. And so really what religion does is it's used very conveniently to create that very divine-like humanity that it's espoused upon white America, while excluding everyone else. And we're in a situation now where that's being challenged, because there are plenty of white, especially working people, who are struggling in the United States. But at the same time, there's always an impulse to ensure that the sanctity of the United States as a God-like country is ultimately painted and defined as a white man's country. And that's part of the Trump phenomenon. But that's not only the Trump phenomenon. Trump has arisen because ultimately both political parties and the entire ruling establishment of the United States espouses, and much of the population of white America espouses to this idea that God has ordained them to settle on native land. God has ordained them to be the arbiters of what democracy looks like and what it means. And God has ordained them to tell not only how black Americans should live in the United States, not only how native people should live, or people who migrate to the United States from countries that the United States destroys, Honduras, Guatemala, but we also have the right to tell people around the world, in Russia and China, anywhere where the United States has an interest in extending its tentacles, that those people over there have the right to listen, or ultimately that they better listen to the dictates of what the God-like nation says. So I feel like religion serves as another layer of the superiority complex of American exceptionalism, which is a white superiority complex.
That's the voice of Danny Haifong, co-author with Roberto Servent of a new book, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Has a foreword by Ajamu Baraka and an afterword by Glenn Ford. After this musical break, we'll continue our conversation about this book and the topic with author Danny Haifong. Stay with us.
How could this be the land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous Holocaust, and the home of the slaves? Corporate America dancing off beat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sparks the terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga.
El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still wanna take me to prison just cause I won't trade humanity for patriotism. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brain, suggestive thinking, causing your perspective to change. They wanna rearrange the whole point of view of the ghetto. The fourth branch of the government wants to settle a bandana full of glittering generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror. But what's reality? Read about the history of the place that we live in and stop letting corporate news tell lies to your children.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with activist and journalist and author Danny Haifong. He lives in the New York City area. He's a regular contributor to Black Agenda Report and American Herald Tribune. He's co-author with Roberto Servant of a new book, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. That's out by Skyhorse Publishing. Danny Haifong, before the break, Chase and you were talking about the role of religion, God, particularly in a theocratic way, Christianity, and the way in which used as a backdrop, a prop, if you will, for the concept of American exceptionalism. And the subtitle of your book goes from the American Revolution to the War on Terror. So when I was listening to you talk, I couldn't help but immediately think and remember the remarks of then-President George W. Bush, September 14th, 2001, just after the 9/11 attacks at the Episcopal National Cathedral. The National Cathedral. He made remarks on a National Day of Prayer and Remembrance service. And it basically was sort of a rallying cry for the war on terror. And Bush, in fact, went on to say, from the cathedral, from the pulpit, he said, quote, "War has been waged against us by stealth and deceit and murder. This nation is peaceful, but fierce when stirred to anger," right? Riffing on the Pearl Harbor myth. He goes on, "This conflict was begun on the timing and terms of others. It will end in a way at an hour of our choosing." Well, apparently we haven't chosen that yet. He goes on to finish. He says, "On this day of national prayer and remembrance, we ask Almighty God to watch over our nation and grant us patience and resolve in all that is to come. We pray that He," capital H, "will comfort and console those who now walk in sorrow. We thank Him for each life we now must mourn and the promise of life to come. As we've been assured, neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height nor depth can separate us from God's love. May He bless the souls of the departed, may He comfort our own, and may He always guide our country. God bless America." You know, I can't tell if that's Billy Graham, an evangelical preacher on cable TV. And I mean no disrespect, of course, to the dead and the tragedy of 9/11. But my goodness, that's dripping with the theology of an ideological American exceptionalism that riffs on the violence of organized forgetting of our history and not having an accurate accounting of it. And just one more quick example of that before I want to hear you continue what you were saying before the break is that this also happened to remind me of another incident, the way American exceptionalism is used. And you talk about this in the book. The way it's used is to silence critics, right? It's almost as if the American exceptionalist mindset is a religion, and anyone who criticizes its official narrative is guilty of blasphemy. And this was most obvious in an interview with the theologian David Ray Griffin, also a scholar who's written a dozen books about the 9/11 attacks, and in an interview with Tucker Carlson. Carlson told Griffin that it was, quote, "wrong, blasphemous, and sinful for you to suggest, imply, or help other people come to the conclusion that the U.S. government killed 3,000 of its own citizens," because it didn't. And look, I'm not going to get into contemporary historiography in 9/11 here, but that kind of a statement is very clear. It's a shot across the bow in the major media that if anybody dares ask critical questions of an official narrative, is somehow a blasphemer against the religion of American exceptionalism. Could you comment on that?
It's a really important point. We can look at it in many different ways. In the book, we talk a lot about how not only is the religion of American exceptionalism meant to silence critics in its own right, just by the sheer fact that it is repeated so much and that it's supposed to overpower any alternative critiques or analyses about their true history and contemporary reality of the United States, but also that there is a material reality where American exceptionalism is defended at all costs by the state, and that this has had dire consequences for especially U.S. political prisoners, mainly deriving from the Black Liberation Movement of the 60s and 70s and its allied organizations, that there are still dozens of political prisoners who are suffering the consequences of challenging American exceptionalist mythology through the organization of Black people to assert their self-determination. And we can also look at, we don't talk about too much in the book, but it's so relevant, the case of Julian Assange today, where WikiLeaks is being criminalized and Assange himself being criminalized for publishing documents that reflected the reality of U.S. war crimes around the world. That is the exact charge against Assange, and he's at risk of dying in prison because of that act of what should be heroism. So there is that reality to this religion that not only is it a belief system, but it's a belief system that's meant to protect a class structure in the United States, which is predicated upon the silencing of who have been deemed the savages, the people who are othered or who dehumanized, those who are meant to be exploited and oppressed. It is meant to silence them by force and also through ideological conditioning, and that those two processes can never be separated from each other.
Danny Haifong, I think one of the best ways to drive home this argument of American exceptionalism and American innocence is with a real-life example. One came to mind at the beginning of our conversation at the top of the hour, where we were talking about the U.S. nuclear bombs that we dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think it's really interesting that a lot of our foreign policy over the last decade has been about making sure that other nations, threatening nations, don't develop nuclear missiles because then they might use them. And it's almost hypocritical because there's only one nation in the world that has ever dropped nuclear bombs, and it is the U.S. So can you speak to either that example or another real-life hypocritical example where American exceptionalism and American innocence reveals itself so blatantly?
That's a great example to start with. The whole process right now on the Korean Peninsula, where the U.S. ruling class is hell-bent on trying to stop the momentum of the Korean people and unifying across borders and through the denuclearization process, that the whole narrative of the ruling class and the suspicions around, especially the hypocritical suspicions around Trump's decision to actually meet with Kim Jong-un over the course of the last 2 years, has been the fact that we can't trust Kim Jong-un, the leader of the DPRK, because he is inherently, and this is where the racism of American exceptionalism comes in, he is an inherently depraved human being who cannot be trusted because he's leading an autocratic dictatorship, when the reality is that the United States has over 7,000 nuclear weapons, has used them on Japan, and has threatened to use them many different times throughout the course of history. After World War II, it threatened China with nuclear weapons during the Korean War. It threatened Korea with nuclear weapons during the Korean War. That the reality of the situation was that the whole arms race was about threatening the world. The arms race in the Cold War period was about threatening the Soviet Union, because if the Soviet Union got too powerful, the United States could always play the nuclear card. So there's that example of the whole nuclear weapons conversation. You know, Obama had the $1 trillion renewal plan under his administration, and then Trump not only reinforced that, but added to it. And so the U.S. is again in another nuclear arms race against Russia and China, yet it still claims that Iran, for example, can't develop its own nuclear capacity to meet its people's needs when Iran is under debilitating sanctions, where its people are dying from treatable medical conditions because it is being excluded from the international community by the United States, which is an act of war. Then we can also look at, for example, what happened in Libya, where in 2011, the U.S. used its institution of NATO to invade Libya in 2011. And the whole narrative around that was that Muammar Gaddafi was a dictator who was killing his own people. Yet when the U.S. and the NATO overthrew Libya and overthrew the government led by Gaddafi, the country was overrun by jihadists. These are the folks that were placed into power in Libya. So there's this hypocritical notion of the fact that the United States has the ordained right to intervene around the world and in order to make a country better, and that its weapons and that its superiority militarily and economically is what is going to improve the condition of people around the world. But yet we always see time and time again, not only is it so hypocritical that the United States would even say this based upon the conditions that people, for example, black people live in the United States, the majority of which are asset poor. But the same goes abroad, where wherever the United States touches turns not to gold, but to misery and to chaos. Yet we are continuing to promote, the United States as ruling class continues to promote this idea that interventions abroad are a democratic project and are a project for human rights. So there are many aspects to this thread of American exceptionalism that runs through the entire political apparatus in the United States.
So you brought up another great example there, which is how the last 2 years in America, we've been talking about election meddling from foreign actors, whereas there's probably no country that's been a bigger perpetrator of that than the United States. What I'm seeing out of your book here is that American exceptionalism and American innocence, when it becomes practical, it is setting different standards for ourselves than what we set for other countries. And I constantly, to be objective, try to look at when we're mad at another country for doing something, ask myself, well, what would it look like if the situation was flipped? And it's very clear that we are holding ourselves to much different standards than we hold any other nation in the world. Would that be a good summary of how this plays out in real life?
I would say so. The conditions in the United States are nothing to cheer about for the majority of people, half of whom could be considered poor. And the fact that the United States is exceptional in its ability to incarcerate millions of people, it's exceptional in its ability to have its police forces kill black people in the streets at a near daily rate. That is what the United States is exceptional for. But when it comes to people abroad, none of that is taken into account, because the interests of the multinational corporations and the banks and the military-industrial complex, they ultimately set the narratives in the corporate media as their arm, their information arm. They set the narrative about how people around the world should live, even though the mythology of it all is in the fact that the United States' standard for how other people should live is completely devoid of any substance. And most of it is sloganeering and talking points just to get the project done. Because at the end of the day, what we see in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, Syria, wherever the United States has extended its tentacles. We see it in Venezuela, where the U.S.'s coup attempt is set to install a puppet who was ultimately seeking to steal the resources. And that's what's exactly happened in Venezuela, is that their resources have been stolen from them by the United States. And that Guaido was really just a puppet to facilitate that process to a greater degree than what they were able to do through sanctions and through the literal theft of resources, like what the United Kingdom did and their allegiance to the U.S.'s policy there. So we have this situation where the standard is the standard of what the empire wants for others, but really it's thinking about itself. So it's just a talking point in order to ensure social tranquility here. There would be a much bigger anti-war movement if the United States' ruling class was upfront about why it was waging wars abroad, especially in a moment where so many people are looking for things like Medicare for All. So many people are looking for policies that improve their conditions. So it would be a real hard sell to say that the United States is expanding its military presence on the African continent in order to contain China's influence. That would not go over too well when people in the United States are seeing trillions of dollars being siphoned to the military. It has to be an objective that can be sold. There's terrorism on the African continent now, so the U.S. is in a war on terror, and thus the U.S. needs to be in Africa, not only overthrowing dictatorships, but also stamping out the terrorism that results from that.
We're speaking with author and journalist Danny Haifong. He is co-author with Roberto Servant of a new book on Skyhorse Publishing called American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. We will conclude our conversation with Danny Haifong after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. Danny Haifong has been our guest today, and in this final segment, we're going to wrap things up. We're talking about the book he co-authored with Roberto Servant, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. Danny Haifong also writes for Black Agenda Report. You can see more of his work online. Danny Haifong, wrapping up here, you gave us much more food for thought there in the last section. I wanted to riff on this. American exceptionalism is reborn into the 21st century with the neoconservative project for the new American century, riffing on the exceptionalist idea of post-World War II and the American century and how America emerges as a unipolar superpower after the collapse of the Soviet Union, only to have its plans befuddled, basically, by the 9/11 attacks. And in fact, in a document published in 2000, called Rebuilding America's Defenses, there was part of it called Creating Tomorrow's Dominant Force. And in that section, there's a quote from the neocons, the neoconservatives, many of whom ended up in the George W. Bush administration, were architects of the so-called War on Terror and the war in Afghanistan and Iraq that has extended to over a half dozen other countries now, much according to PNAC's plan, the Project of New American Century. The quote, ominous enough, is, quote, further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. In other words, how will the plutocrats and the powers that be in the U.S. convince the American public that there is this great force against them and that we will have to invade a half a dozen countries, right? Like just General Wesley Clark pointed out, that this was already written on the wall. We already know that the U.S. was intending to invade Iraq before the events of 9/11. But these policy planners, these war planners, very astute, many of them from the Straussian School at the University of Chicago, they're well aware that the American public is historically anti-war. They had to cajole and propagandize the public into war in World War I, called the Great War, steady streams of propaganda to support the Cold War. The so-called War on Terror has been no different. How do you see that, Danny Haifong? In other words, how do you and Roberto Servant take the thread of American exceptionalism up through the events of 9/11 to today?
In our book, we have a chapter on Russia. If it's bad, blame Russia. And I think that it's a really important question to ask, because what is happening is that process is occurring as we speak, where the U.S. ruling class has told us what the new danger is, and that to them is the rise of Russia and China. However, they're having trouble with the justification for a broader war, not to mention the consequences and the impact of what a broader war with those two emergent superpowers, what that would produce and what that would look like. But Russiagate, since 2016, since the election of Donald Trump, has served as at least the seeds of a new Cold War, which is steadily pumping some of the most ridiculous propaganda, to be honest, even more ridiculous than the Iraq War in many ways, the ways the weapons of mass destruction debacle, not to mention everything else.
Journalist Matt Taibbi called Russiagate this generation's WMD.
Right. And in many ways, it's worse, because not only would the consequences of a greater war with Russia be graver, not to minimize the million plus people that have died because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, but this is a war that could be of nuclear proportion, and the lies, the sinister lies of the very same neocon talking heads that are now on places like MSNBC, like Bill Kristol, for example, they're the ones who are now saying that there needs to be a drumbeat to war with Russia, and that they are fortifying concrete plans to make that happen, and they've already have instituted it in many ways through the suppression of independent left forces in the United States and in Europe, through social media, for example. They've instituted it through the sanctions against Russia, through the continued surrounding of Russia with NATO military weapons and endless provocations along Russia's border with Eastern Europe. This is continuing to happen, and it is dangerous, and that, I think, is the next phase of the way that American exceptionalism, which I think is on life support in many ways. And that was another important part of our book, was to show that not only is American exceptionalism, especially as a liberal ideology, as an ideology rooted in liberalism, and that liberalism is not our friend, was another big point of the book, but we also were trying to convey that this ideology is really running up against some pretty significant contradictions that more and more people are beginning to realize. Not only in the United States, but this is a global movement away from this idea that the U.S. is a hegemonic power that deserves the right to lead the world in whatever direction that it so chooses. And so that this new global movement away from that is going to ramp up not only the propaganda that we hear, because it is intense right now in the corporate media. We could talk for days about how this looks like in the 2020 elections, where nearly the entire 20 candidates that the U.S. ruling class threw up there against Bernie Sanders were all about how do we promote this idea that the U.S. is already great, like Hillary Clinton did, but at the same time, try to address the fact that so many people are suffering. And so this contradiction between the suffering and the ideology of American exceptionalism, which silences that suffering, is coming to a real climax point. And so we have to really look at how the U.S. ruling class is desperately seeking to embed the notion of American exceptionalism into our minds right now in order to justify real grave and dangerous policies like the drive towards Russia, which is the next phase in this move to preserve the spoils of empire that the United States' ruling class is ultimately seeking to do. That's its most important objectives, in our opinion.
So, Danny Haifeng, I want to get your analysis on an interesting example of American exceptionalism rearing its head in today's political environment, and that is that Trump ran his campaign on the idea of making America great again, therefore implying that America has somehow lost its greatness or was not at the moment great. But then what we see is that now, as president, when members of Congress talk about how we need to improve America, or when they criticize America, what we see is the kind of attitude that, well, if you don't like it, then get out and leave. Whereas it totally contradicts the idea of running on a campaign of make America great again. So I'm wondering if you can kind of dive in a little bit onto why it is that it was okay for Trump to say make America great again, implying that it was not great or is not great. But when other maybe different colors or segments of our society try to criticize the United States, that it's somehow a, well, then get out of the country attitude.
This points to the very real white supremacist roots of what it means to make America great in the first place. Trump did speak to some of the issues that, I mean, even at some point in his campaign, he had to give a nod to Sanders about Medicare for All. But that was all political expediency. The election was a very complicated moment, but at the same time, a very simple one, where the current establishment neoliberal policy of endless austerity and war was really being put on trial during that election. Sanders on the one end and Trump on the right wing end. But at the end of the day, what Trump was saying was to make America great again, this had to become a white man's country again. So that meant white man's jobs, that meant white man's protection and safety from endless wars, that also meant white man's safety from the invading hordes of Mexico. And that's why we had that contradiction exist in Trump's campaign rhetoric, was because the ultimate objective was to throw red meat at a really disaffected Republican Party base that had been betrayed by its original white man's party's representatives, the Jeb Bushes of the world, the Ted Cruzes, all of them had been seen as political liabilities by that point. And so Trump steamrolled over them. And so when people like, for example, Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Cortez, or even Bernie Sanders begin to talk about some policies that may make America great in their perspective, whether it's healthcare for all, or whether it's increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour, Trump immediately decries those as socialist policies, as policies that reflect the reality that those folks don't appreciate the United States. They don't appreciate how great it already is. And so that contradiction sits and stands as it is because, at the end of the day, the whole narrative of the United States being great or not great is undergirded by white supremacy. And so any real attempt to transform the United States disrupts that reality, disrupts and really angers anyone who has a real vested interest in preserving white rule and preserving imperial rule. And so that is the big difference, I think, between the so-called democratic socialists on the one end and the Trump phenomenon. But at the same time, what's really dangerous about all of this is the fact that for real social transformation to occur, there needs to be a deeper conversation about white supremacy and about the imperial superpower of the United States, that it cannot just be confined to reforms to make the United States great, because we know that the United States is constructed in such a way that black people are inherently excluded from any benefit that occur usually in the United States, unless there is an organized movement to fight all of the manifestations of white supremacy that ensure the self-determination of peoples around the world, black people in the United States and Native people, that there needs to be a deeper conversation about what that looks like, because at the end of the day, we can't just be talking about how do we make America great from a leftist perspective. That's short-sighted and doesn't take into account that the fact that the roots of the United States are stained with the and tainted by its origin story, its development, the empire rooted in slavery and indigenous genocide.
We've been speaking with Danny Haifong for the hour. He is co-author with Roberto Servant of a new book on Skyhorse Publishing, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. And this book, you can learn more about it at skyhorsepublishing.com. Praise for American Exceptionalism and American Innocence. Cornel West has said great things about the book. John Pilger has as well, as has Cynthia McKinney, former congresswoman, now professor. Stephen Kinzer, a former New York Times correspondent, says this wide-ranging book seeks to weave our history and our modern-day reality together. It may seem radical, but it is not as radical as what our leaders are doing today to suppress human freedom at home and abroad. You also have Michael Peretti, Dan Kovalik, many people signing off here on this book, so congratulations and kudos to you, Danny Haifong, and Roberto Servant for this book. Listeners, you can read more of Daniel Haifong's work, blackagendareport.com. And Danny Haifong, thanks so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, and Dennis Murphy is our associate producer. The Project Censored Show airs on over 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archived programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to The Project Censored Show on YouTube and your cell phone's podcast app. Feel free to share your feedback about our work, and last but not least, thanks to all of you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
We all know that washing our hands regularly, wearing a face mask, and sanitizing surfaces helps prevent the spread of COVID-19 to others. But you may ask, what can I do for myself? The California Department of Public Health has compiled a list of how to combat stress during the stay-at-home orders. Ensure you're getting the proper nutrition, not just delivery fast food from an app. Engage in 60 minutes of physical activity. This can be working in your garden, walking your dog, or putting your favorite KZFR program on and dancing for an hour. More tips to manage stress can be found at covid19.ca.gov. That's covid19.ca.gov. www.gov.gov.